Good morning. This is Focus 580, a morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. Americans now spend something like $200 billion a year on prescription drugs, and prices for pharmaceuticals continue to rise much faster than the general rate of inflation. Some of us spend thousands of dollars every year on medications, and millions of people have turned to buying drugs from Canada, where prices are dramatically lower than in the United States. Congress recently passed and the president signed a new Medicare prescription drug benefit for senior citizens. But now we're learning that the price tag could exceed $500 billion, and the new law forbids negotiations between the federal government and the drug companies for lower prices. How did it get this way, and what to do about it? During this hour of Focus 580, we'll get the perspective of someone who has had a front row seat from which to observe changes in the pharmaceutical industry and the impact on healthcare over the past two decades. Dr. Marcia Angel, is a former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. She's the author of a book that must be driving the industry nuts. It is entitled The Truth About Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us, and What to Do About It, recently published by Random House. In the book, Dr. Angel examines the state of the pharmaceutical industry, which she says has spun dangerously out of control. We'll talk with Dr. Angel about her analysis and her recommendations for reform during this hour. As we do so, we invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us around Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, or if you're listening online anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. Your questions are welcome. A bit more about our guest, Dr. Marcia Angel is a board-certified pathologist, having trained in both internal medicine and pathology at the Boston University School of Medicine. She writes frequently in professional journals and the general press on a wide range of topics, including medical ethics, health policy, the nature of medical evidence, the relations between industry and academic medicine, among other things. She's the author of a previous critically acclaimed book, Science on Trial, The Clash Between Medical Evidence and the Law in the Breast Implant Case. And Dr. Angel is currently a senior lecturer in the Department of Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School, and she joins us this morning by telephone. Dr. Angel, good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
Now, you were at the New England Journal of Medicine for about two decades.
That's right, 21 years.
Okay. And you say you observed major changes in the pharmaceutical industry during that time. What did you observe?
Well, as it grew wealthier and more powerful, it began to exercise a lot of influence over the way research was done on its own products. It also began to exercise more influence over what doctors learned about the use of prescription drugs. I felt that this was really dangerous.
Now, you say there was a major pro-business shift in government policy beginning around 1980 that brought profound changes to the pharmaceutical industry. Talk about what happened.
Well, part of it was just the atmosphere. You may remember that when Reagan became president, suddenly there was a very strong pro-business culture in society as a whole, and this extended to the pharmaceutical industry. And it took the form of very concrete laws that were passed by Congress that were quite friendly to this industry. In 1980, for example, Congress passed the Bayh-Dole Act, and that essentially enabled the pharmaceutical industry to live off of government-funded research done at university and government labs. Later, Hatch-Waxman was passed. That enabled the drug companies to manipulate their exclusive marketing rights in such a way that they could extend it for many years sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
In 1987, at the industry's behest, Congress passed a law that prohibited anyone except the manufacturers from importing drugs from other countries. That made it so that Americans for a long time were ignorant of the great price disparities between this country and Europe and Canada. In 1997, Congress passed a law that did many things to favor industry. It gave them 6 months longer patent lives if they tested their drugs in children, something that they should have been doing anyway in many cases, but they were bribed to do it. It lowered the standards for review of direct-to-consumer advertising, and that began the flood of TV advertising, direct-to-consumer, that we now see. It lowered the FDA standards for approving a new drug. Drugs could be approved with less stringent research. So in many ways, this industry has enjoyed all kinds of favors from Congress since 1980.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk in some detail about a number of those things, and, mm-hmm. and I'll try to make the questions clear. Maybe the best way to start would be with the claim of the pharmaceutical industry that prices have to be this high to support the research, that the costs of drugs are very high, but that goes back into developing all these new wonderful drugs that they're making available on the market. What's wrong with that claim?
Well, it's not true. That's what's wrong with that claim. In fact, what the claim implies is that these companies are spending most of their money on research and development, and that afterwards they have only enough left over for modest profits. Both of those implications are simply not true. The major drug companies spend relatively little on research and development. In 2002, for example, the top 10 American companies that were listed on the Fortune 500 spent 14% of their sales on research and development. But that same year, they spent over twice that, 31%, on marketing and administration. The lion's share of that was for marketing. And even after all these expenditures, they were left with 17% of sales as profits, more than they had spent in research and development. That's a tremendous profit margin. That year, the other Fortune 500 companies, or all of the Fortune 500 companies, had median profits of only 3%. So you can see that the pharmaceutical industry was doing almost six times as well as other Fortune 500 companies.
That wasn't
sure. Unusual. Until last year, year after year after year, for over two decades, the pharmaceutical industry was the most profitable in the United States. So it wasn't a matter of boom or bust. It was consistent. Last year, for the first time, the industry fell slightly from first place to third place, but still well ahead of the median. And there were some special circumstances for that slight dip.
Now, the claim about the cost of research, as you've given some percentages to it in relation to the marketing expenses and the profit margins in the pharmaceutical industry, but looking closer at the actual research, this is something that your book covers in great detail.
Yes.
It turns out that the pharmaceutical industry actually does very little research on its own. Where is the research conducted?
Well, it does a certain kind of research. It spends most of its R&D money on the late stages of development, that is, clinical trials. But about a quarter of those trials are what are called phase four studies. These are trials of drugs already on the market, and many of those are little more than gimmicks to pay doctors to prescribe drugs. But that's where most of the R&D dollars go, the clinical trials, which happen after a drug has gone through the early research and the preclinical phase of development.
Okay, I certainly want to follow up on that. Prior to that, maybe we could talk about the phases of research. How do they actually make it to the market from scratch?
Well, the first thing you have to know is what causes the disease or the medical condition that you're trying to treat, and that can take decades to find out. You may never find that out, but decades of very basic research, almost all of which is funded by the government, by the NIH. And only after you understand the sequence of events that leads to the medical condition, usually at a molecular level, can you come up with a possible target that a drug could target to break that chain?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to find the molecules that correspond to the target, And then you get into the later stages of development where you look at how they work in tissue cultures and in animals and so forth. And then eventually you bring it to human studies, beginning with what are called phase one studies, in which you test it in a small number of patients, volunteers, to try to learn something about the drug's mechanisms of action, its way of being excreted, its side effects, its dosage ranges, safe dosage ranges. Then it would move on to phase two studies where you would use it in a larger number of people who actually have the condition that you want to treat. Phase one studies are often done in normal people. So then use it in somebody, in people who have the condition, sometimes comparing it with another drug or a placebo, but often not. That gives you a better feel for the way the drug is handled in patients who really have the condition, and the best dosage to use. Often in these phase two studies, different doses are tried. And then the phase three studies are the big studies. Sometimes tens of thousands of patients who have the condition, and they usually compare the new drug with the placebo, sometimes with an older treatment for the same condition. These are the studies that are submitted by the companies. All these are sponsored by the companies. These are the studies that are submitted by the companies to the FDA. The FDA doesn't do its own research. It simply reviews these studies that are submitted to it by the companies. And if they find that in the phase three studies the drug is reasonably safe and reasonably effective, then it's approved. Only after a drug has FDA approval can it be sold, can it actually go on the market.
Okay. That's very helpful. Now stepping back to the earlier stages of this research, the basic research into the causes of a disease and to try to find a site that can be addressed by a molecule, that is typically done at research universities and National Institutes of Health, essentially?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, almost exclusively.
Yeah.
The drug companies are not innovative anymore. Their major product is drugs that are very similar to drugs already being sold, minor variations. These are called copycat or me-too drugs. Mm-hmm. And that's what the drug companies turn out. They are trying to cash in on an already established lucrative market, or sometimes a company may make a me-too drug to get a new patent and extend exclusive marketing rights in that way. A good example of that is Nexium. Nexium is virtually identical to Prilosec, but Prilosec was going off-market. It was a big seller for the British firm AstraZeneca. It was going off-market in 2001. It would have left AstraZeneca, or not going off-market, going off-patent, It would have left AstraZeneca high and dry. So what the company did was to patent this virtually identical drug, call it Nexium, and then get exclusive marketing rights for Nexium. And it put, the company put about $500 million in the first year to convert Prilosec users to Nexium through marketing, through constant marketing. And I think Nexium is still the most heavily marketed drug.
Mm-hmm. Now, this kind of gets to the heart of where the profits from the industry come from.
Right.
The issue of monopoly rights. How does this work? How are the rights to drugs owned, essentially?
Well, drug companies patent. They obtain many, many patents on each drug all the way along the line of research and development. When they get approval from the FDA, they also get exclusive marketing rights from the FDA. That's a little bit different from a patent, but they're backups for each other in a sense. And the patent lasts on a drug for 20 years from the time the patent is filed, so that's 20 years. But the time it takes to test the drug in clinical trials is taken away from that patent life. The drug companies want to patent it before the trials because at that point it becomes well known what the drug is, and they want to own the drug. But they can't sell the drug until the clinical trials are done and the drug has gotten FDA approval. So you have to subtract from the 20 years the time for that, and that is roughly 6 years nowadays. So they have about 14 years on their primary patent. The FDA then gives exclusive marketing rights after they have approved a drug, depending on the kind of drug, for orphan drugs, 7 years, for new chemical compounds, usually five, for new formulations or new indications for a drug, maybe three, and that operates in parallel to the patent.
Okay. So another example of the way this has played out in certain cases, you were mentioning, I forget the drug that you mentioned before. There's so many drugs, I can't remember the names, but one that people will know right away is Claritin, that recently, just maybe 3 years ago, the patent expired on Claritin, and it became, you know, essentially in the public domain, and then there were generic versions of Claritin on the market over the counter. And the response of the company that owned Claritin was to develop a, as you call it, a Me Too drug that they could then market in place of Claritin and essentially make us think that this was the replacement for Claritin.
Right. The Schering Plough, which is the company that made Claritin, was faced with exactly the same sort of situation that AstraZeneca was faced with Prilosec. And they tried to do pretty much the same thing. They patented a metabolite of Claritin, which is just what Claritin turns into when you swallow it, and named that Clarinex, tried to do what AstraZeneca did with successfully converting patients and doctors from Prilosec to Nexium. Schering Plough tried to convert patients from Claritin to Clarinex, but they were a little slow off the mark. They were having some problems with the FDA in their manufacturing standards. They had to clean up some of their plants. That slowed them down. And so they didn't catch the crest of the wave in the same way that AstraZeneca did, and they've been much less successful at converting doctors and patients from Claritin to Clarinex. I suspect that the similarity in the names has been a problem, too. People could imagine that Nexium was a different drug from Prilosec because the name was different. It's harder to make that case.
It even sounds like it's the next drug. It's got Nex in it. You know,
right,
so, yeah.
right. I didn't even think of that. That's a good point. But it's really just a form of Prilosec.
Yeah. We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. Let me just briefly reintroduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Dr. Marcia Angell. Her last name, by the way, is A-N-G-E-L-L, two L's. She's the author of the book, The Truth About Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us, and What to Do About It. Dr. Angell spent 2 decades with the New England Journal of Medicine, and we're talking with her this morning about her book. We do have a couple callers and time for others if you'd like to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I have a listener on a cell phone on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I'd like you to extend your sort of conspiracy approach to the what's happened in this town. Under Carl Care, I was under Prilosec when it was still experimental and they were giving you warnings about mice getting cancers. And then it was accepted, and then the HMO said, no, we don't want to cover Prilosec. We're going to cover Omeprazole, or I'm not sure which what that's actually called. And then they said,
that's the same drug.
Okay, right. And then we're going to cover, Prilosec OTC, but you could only buy those in containers that older people, and I'll include myself in that, can't even get those pills out of, and they don't. have bottles of them anymore. You know, they're these single tabs. And half the time you crush the tab before you get it out. And then they took Nexium, which they would cover, and they turned it into a Tier 3, which means it costs $25 instead of $5. There's a lot of manipulation going on by the HMOs, and I want to know, are they doing it for themselves, or are they doing it in collusion with the drug companies? What I do know is that basically the consumers are getting a really bad deal out of all of these changes, and everyone just basically, I think, much like airlines, they try to keep you so totally confused that you have no idea where to go to find out what you should be taking and whether you should be paying more for the next tier. Is that a different drug? And why don't the HMO let you get the generic? And I mean, so that's, I'd like you to just talk a little bit about who are all the people who are involved in basically screwing the medical consumer. Thank you.
Well, that's a very good question. It is a very confusing situation out there, in part because the industry tries to keep secret exactly what they're charging which payers for the same drugs. The prices vary a lot. They're complicated systems of rebates and discounts. So it is very hard to wrap your mind around it. Yes, there is often a form of collusion between the HMOs and hospitals and the drug companies. And let me give you an example of that. In Boston, two of the teaching hospitals of Harvard Medical School have Nexium on their formulary, despite the fact that it would be cheaper to buy over-the-counter Prilosec. I don't know how hard it is to get into the package. I haven't tried it. But the reason the hospitals have Nexium, this much more expensive brand-name drug, on their formularies is that the company practically gives the drug to the hospitals. So the hospitals are worried about their own bottom line, and they are essentially being bribed to use Nexium. But what happens is when the patient is discharged from the hospital, he usually is discharged with a prescription for Nexium, and then someone else has to pay those high prices. So I think that's the kind of thing that you're talking about.
Yeah, and our lines are all full. I want to get to as many calls as I can, but just a quick follow-up. You describe in the book what can only be termed, an assault, a marketing assault on doctors and hospitals by the pharmaceutical industry. That's one of their strategies, essentially, to get doctors to prescribe their drugs.
That's right. We are all aware of the direct-to-consumer advertising, and there certainly is a lot of it on television, but that is small potatoes compared with the marketing that targets doctors. Doctors have to write the prescriptions, and the drug companies are all over doctors. They pay for most continuing medical education. They pay for most medical conferences, most meetings of professional societies. They send legions of sales representatives to doctors' offices all the time. They bring with them free samples, but those free samples are not for generic drugs. They're for the very newest, most expensive brand-name drugs with long patent lives ahead of them, so that when the free samples run out, you and your doctor will be hooked on these drugs. Wherever there are doctors, there are drug companies, and they have, to a large extent, taken over the education of doctors about prescription drugs.
We have full lines here. Let's go on and talk with some more callers. We'll go next to a Chicago listener on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. I had to come away, so I'm not sure if you went on to talk about the research costs, supposedly, that drug companies have. It's my understanding, and please correct this, that most of the basic research on drugs is probably done in land-grant universities by using university facilities, university graduate students, and university faculties. So I'm sort of feeling like the public really pays for most research into pharmaceuticals. And my other question is about doctors' complicity, because during the Nixon administration, when they tried to do nutrition guidelines, the AMA was all over them saying that yelling about biochemical individuality, but now I see doctors prescribing a small group of brand name drugs to everybody, regardless of the biochemical individuality. And I'm having a problem with that, and I'm having a problem with doctors not having enough time to really talk with the patient to see if this drug is really good for this person or if the side effects would not be good. So those are my two questions or points.
Let me start with the first question, because you're quite right about that. The most research and development at the early stages, and certainly most innovation, is funded by taxpayers, mainly through the NIH, and carried out at universities and at the NIH itself. Let me go back to the Me Too drugs for a second, because I mentioned that these drugs are the major product now of the drug companies. If you look at the last 6 years and all of the drugs that came on the market in those 6 years, and there were about 487 of them that is approved by the FDA in this time, you find that 78% of them were classified by the FDA as unlikely to be better than drugs already being sold. And 68% didn't even consist of new chemical compounds. They were simply old drugs and new combinations and slightly different formulations. So that shows you the size of the Me Too market. It's huge. What about the innovative drugs? In those 6 years, there were really just out of the 487 drugs, only 67 were innovative in the sense, that's only 14%, incidentally, were innovative in the sense that they contained new chemical compounds and were classified as likely to be improvements over old drugs already being sold. Those drugs were based primarily on publicly funded research. And then at some point, the big drug companies acquire or use this research to do the later development of drugs. They now also license about a third of their drugs, often now from small biotech companies, sometimes from universities and from the NIH. So they really do, for the little bit of innovation that they do, they count on publicly funded research. Even the Me Too drugs, and this is an important point, take Lipitor. Lipitor is the top-selling drug in the world, but it's a Me Too drug. It's the fourth of six very similar cholesterol-lowering drugs of the same type. If you look at these families of Me Too drugs, you often find that the first one was based on publicly funded research in universities. And then the drug companies spin out variations on the same theme over many years. In the case of these cholesterol-lowering drugs, the first one was called Mevacor. It came on the market in 1987, and it was based on university work primarily. After that, it was an easy matter to turn out the other Me Too's. Mevacor is now available as a generic. It's called lovastatin. But it can't compete with Lipitor because there's no marketing muscle behind it. Now, the second issue you raise, doctors, there are two issues in your comment. It's hard for doctors to individualize drug treatment because you rarely know enough to do that about drugs. When you study drugs, even the most honest research has got to take a group of similar patients. It can't do it one at a time. So doctors can do some trial and error, but that's a difficult thing. I think what you're also pointing to is the extent to which the doctors are now in the thrall of the pharmaceutical industry. The medical profession has largely abdicated its responsibility to teach doctors about the use of prescription drugs. So by default, they learn from drug companies. And what they learn from drug companies is a highly drug-intensive style of medicine. Doctors come to believe, just as patients do, that the newer drugs must be better than the older drugs. I think that's kind of an American belief anyway. Newer is always better. And they come to accept the propaganda that new brand name drugs should be used, if possible. So they really, to some extent, are manipulated by the drug companies because the profession is not doing the job it should be doing.
I hope that gets to the caller's question. We have a lot of people weighing, and I want to get right onto them, but there are a couple things that also might be relevant to the question that was posed by the Chicago listener. And one of the things that you said, and in fact, relating to the kinds of research that are being done, is it in fact the case that new formulations of drugs are not compared to old ones, but merely to placebos?
Well, new drugs are not compared with old ones. The FDA will approve a new drug if it's compared in clinical trials to a placebo, and that's a sugar pill. And that's a very low standard. All it requires is that the new drug be better than nothing. But that isn't what doctors and patients want to know. They want to know whether the new drug is better than what they're already using. The drug companies don't compare their new drugs with older drugs for the same condition at equivalent doses. They don't want to know the answer to that. If sometimes they do compare a new drug with an old drug at too low a dose, so then the new drug looks better. But they seldom compare a new drug with an old drug at equivalent doses. If they had to do that to get FDA approval, then that would pull the rug out of the Me Too market, because probably most new drugs would not be better than the old ones at comparable doses. And it's even possible that with successive Me Too drugs, they're getting worse and not better. There's just no way to know unless they're tested, but they're not. What they do is compare the new drugs with placebo, get FDA approval, and then rely on marketing to try to convince doctors and patients that one is better than another when there's no scientific evidence whatsoever.
Okay. And also going back to the issue of research being conducted at land-grant universities, for example,
I don't know what a land-grant university is.
Oh, okay. Well, that's like the University of Illinois.
Oh, I see. No. They're done at all of the major research universities, not land-grant in particular. But it's funded by the NIH.
Okay. I guess the question I was trying to get to is the nature that the companies often make contractual arrangements with the research that is being mm-hmm. conducted in these places. This is something that was enabled and encouraged essentially by the Bayh-Dole Act that said that these research institutions could share in the profits from.
Right.
From the research that they were conducting. And I guess I wanted to ask you to comment on what effect that has had on the objectivity of the research, or maybe the kinds of research that is being done.
There are two issues there. One is Bayh-Dole. And what Bayh-Dole said was that universities could patent publicly funded, the fruits of publicly funded research, and then give exclusive licenses to drug companies. Before that, publicly funded research was in the public domain. This essentially made partners out of the universities and the drug companies, because when they would license the fruits of their research to drug companies, they would get a royalty on the drugs that were sold afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So that changed the atmosphere in the academic medical centers. They began to think of themselves as handmaidens of industry and began to behave that way. The other thing you're talking about is the increasing influence over the way the clinical research is done at academic medical centers. The drug companies have always paid for the research, have paid for the clinical trials on their own drugs, and usually have given grants to universities to perform that research. But they used to do it at arm's length. They used to say, here's a grant. If you're interested, would you study our new drug? And then they would stand back and cross their fingers and hope the drug looked good. The faculty researchers would actually design how the study was going to be done. They would analyze the data. They would write the paper. They would decide where to submit it, whether it would be reported, and so forth. That changed. Over the two decades I was at the New England Journal of Medicine, I saw the drug companies begin to exercise influence over every detail of the research. They began to design the studies, to keep the data, to write the papers, and to decide whether the papers would ever be published, and if so, what they would say. That was not arm's length anymore, and it introduced bias into clinical research, which I believe has distorted in recent years the medical literature seriously. They would design studies that incorporated bias. For example, they might design a study of a drug that's meant to be used in old people, but design it so that it was studied in young people who were less likely to have side effects. Or, and this is very common, they would design a study comparing a new drug with placebos, not just to get FDA approval, but because the people who read the medical journals would think that the drug was better just because it was better than placebo. And the researchers would know that that wasn't the right question, that the question was, is it better than what we're already using? But they wouldn't force the company to redesign the study. The faculty researchers were increasingly working as hired hands for the companies, and the companies were biasing the research. And of course, we've heard recently that some of the unfavorable results they simply suppressed altogether. They would publish the favorable results, sometimes many times, and not publish the unfavorable results at all.
And of course, the returns to the research institution can be very, very large. Isn't that right? I mean, I think you said a couple of cases where is it MIT that generally, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in
royalties.
Royalties, exactly.
Yes.
From the research.
Yes.
So there certainly is an incentive to work with the system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It turned medical schools and teaching hospitals into entrepreneurial businesses, in a sense, hand in glove with the drug companies. Mm-hmm.
We have several callers waiting. I'm sorry to make them wait for so long, but we'll go on next to a listener in Champaign on line number 2. Good morning.
Hi, Dr. Angel.
Yes.
A quick question before my cell battery runs out. I have a good friend with ALS, and with all the money that's raised with MDA research, there seems to be no progress. Is it political? Is it money? Or is it just too hard a disease to figure out?
It's a tragic disease.
It's the worst disease I've ever heard of, and yes. I just wonder why more people aren't. I mean, with all the great minds in this world, there's nothing.
I think people are probably working as hard as they can at the NIH, which is where most innovative work is done. I would not look to the drug companies for a cure for this. I would look to the NIH, although the drug companies would end up selling it. But it's just a devastating disease, and we don't have an answer yet.
Is there any political pressure that would help, or it's not really a politics thing? I just think like AIDS gets a lot of attention, but ALS is smaller but much more devastating.
Right. Well, I think there are ALS advocacy groups. I don't know for sure, but it's a very tricky thing because you don't necessarily find the answers from targeted research. Often you find the answers to diseases from basic research that seems to be in a quite separate area, and suddenly it shines light on something quite different. So I would be wary of research that is too targeted to a specific disease.
Hope it gets the caller's question. We'll go on next to someone on a cell phone on line number 3. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a very brief comment and a very brief question. Mm-hmm. The comment is, the source of basic research. I seem to recall that during the space age, the halcyon decades of the space age, that we thought it a good thing that publicly funded research leading to new materials, new techniques, et cetera, et cetera, was a good thing for the nation. I'd be interested in your guest's comments on that. The question concerns publication. Publication, obviously, is very important to the success of drugs, and I understand that the journals, JAMA and the New England, are going to begin doing something different next year. I heard the editor of the journal interviewed on this, I think, last week, mm-hmm. requiring more extensive reporting of research, et cetera, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Both very good points. The first is, I think what you're saying is, why is it a bad thing if the NIH funds the early research and then transfers it to the drug companies? They do the late stage of development and sell the drugs. Isn't this what Bayh-Dole intended, to transfer the fruits of basic research into practical products that could be used at the bedside? And I would say that that's fine, except that the drug companies, by claiming that they're the source of innovation, justify prohibitive prices. If they were willing to acknowledge their much more modest role in this process, then there would be more pressure for them to curtail their price increases. So they just claim more than is true. Also, it's allowed them to get away with concentrating all of their efforts on Me Too drugs and just relying on others for the basic research. They now license about a third of their drugs, often from small biotech companies. So that's the first comment. The second is about, you're talking about the recent statement by the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors. They said that from now on, they will consider papers submitted about drug company-sponsored research only if those companies had registered the clinical trials before the study was done on a publicly available and publicly administered website. This is an important step because what it speaks to is the fact that the drug companies don't publish and don't make available their clinical trials that have unfavorable results. They just publish the favorable ones. And that's distorting the whole medical literature. It's making doctors and the public believe that drugs are a lot better than they are and that they have fewer side effects. So this is an attempt to get at that. It says if you want us to consider your papers for publication, you will have registered this study somewhere. And on that registry, you will tell us what the study is, what patients you're going to study the drug in, how long the study will last, what endpoint you're going to monitor, just all of the factors about that trial. And then when the trial is finished, you'll list on the website the salient results. That way, every single trial that ends up being submitted to a journal will be somewhere, and people can say, if it's not published, well, what happened to that? Here's this trial. We've never seen any results of it. So that's very important, to try to stop the companies from suppressing unfavorable results. But the problem is that it would apply, the journals can only make it apply, to studies that are actually submitted to them. It doesn't apply to all studies that are never even submitted to journals. I think that I would go further and say that there should be a publicly administered registry of all clinical trials, period. Because a clinical trial is using human subjects, and it seems to me that as soon as a drug company enrolls a human subject in an experiment, they acquire some public accountability. They ought to say what happened in that trial. So I would go even further than the journals, but it is an important step.
Yeah, there is a website, clinicaltrials.gov, mm-hmm. that was created to essentially put a registry of trials before the public, and I guess it's sort of part way to that goal. It's mostly voluntary at this point.
That's
as you
problem.
Know.
Yeah. That's the problem. Yeah. And the companies are now quickly saying, "Oh well, we'll put our trials on our own website." But if you look, there are always weasel words. We'll put our important trials or our meaningful trials. No, I think all trials should be on the website.
Okay. We have another caller to talk with, someone in Marshall, Illinois, line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Dr. Angel, for writing that book.
Thank you.
I teach psychiatric nursing, and of course that's so pharmacy intensive. And I try to keep my students' consciousness raised about these pharmaceutical companies and these drugs. A lot of the information I do get from NPR. And I wonder if you would just comment on any of the psychotropics, like the SSRIs. Would they all be considered Me Too drugs after Prozac? Is that too
yes.
much a generalization?
Yes, that's a very good example of a Me Too family. Prozac was an innovative drug. It came on the market in 1987. And since then, other companies have spun out Me Too variants. They, too, do not test their new drugs against older ones at comparable doses. So there's no particular reason to believe that one is any better than another. Also, there's some reason to be much more reticent about using them anyway. We've heard recently about the fact that some of the companies have buried evidence that they that these drugs produce suicidal thoughts in children and adolescents. But what we haven't heard publicized nearly as much is the fact that if you look at all the clinical trials that have been done of the antidepressants, and not just those that are published, there was a study of all of the trials that were submitted to the FDA to get approval for 6 antidepressants. The authors got all of these studies through the Freedom of Information Act. And what you find when you look at all of the studies, and not just the positive ones, is that these drugs are not all that good. Compared with placebo, mm-hmm. The placebo was responsible for 80% of the effect. And the effect itself amounted to, although statistically significant, amounted to, I think it was just 2 points on the 62-point Hamilton depression test,
right.
Which is clinically nothing.
Yes.
Just 2 out of 62 points. So it was true for all 6 of them about equally. They were the 4 SSRIs. And Effexor, and what was the other one? I don't remember.
Lexapro,
I don't remember the other one.
Well,
but
what about the
Surzone? I think. And they were all roughly the same. That is statistically slightly effective,
right.
But probably not clinically so.
And no way to tell if anyone was any better or worse.
Well, they compared. They were all placebo controlled, so
right.
there weren't
right.
direct comparisons.
Never with each
but
other.
They looked at the effects and found that they all had about the same effect.
What about the new generation of antipsychotics? It's pretty much since clozapine, or is clozapine by itself? Would you say?
I haven't followed that research as much. I know there's a lot of concern about side effects, but I just haven't followed it.
Oh.
And also about off-label use.
Right, Neurontin, I heard about that company getting in trouble for off-label marketing for that one.
That's right, but off-label marketing is fairly standard.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Bye-bye.
We have just about maybe 2 minutes left, and I'm sorry, there's a lot we won't be able to cover, obviously, in 1 hour. It's a great book. One of the things that you talk about near the end of the book is the power of the industry in Congress and the regulatory
right.
process, and also, you know, what it would take to reform the situation that you describe throughout the book. And maybe, you know, I could ask you to spend a couple minutes talking about
right.
those things.
Right. Well, this industry has an iron grip on both Congress and the White House, and largely writes its own ticket in Washington. It has the largest lobby in Washington. In 2002, it had 675 lobbyists. That's more than one for every member of Congress. It gives generously to political campaigns, and it gets what it pays for. A good example is the recent Medicare prescription drug benefit. That contains a specific provision that states that Medicare will not negotiate with drug companies for lower prices. Now, that's a startling provision. It makes drugs exempt from the general regulation that goes on in Medicare in general. Medicare regulates doctor fees. It regulates, hospital payments. But prescription drugs were held to be off-limits, no regulation of prices. And what that means is that the prices can continue to rise three times faster than inflation, and the benefit, which was inadequate to begin with, will shortly be wiped out by rising prices. What the Medicare will then try to do is to take that out of seniors' hides in other ways by increasing premiums or increasing deductibles. And we've seen that just this month to try to pay for the drug benefit, or maybe even decreasing other services. I suspect that will happen, too, as this drug benefit just gets unaffordable. But that shows you how much clout this industry has. One thing citizens can do is pay some attention to these prescription drug friendly laws in Congress and let their representatives know that, yeah, you may like the money you get from this industry, but you're going to lose my vote if you keep doing this. I think if members of Congress had to decide between the campaign contributions and the votes, they would take the votes.
Okay. We're going to have to stop there since we're out of time, but I can suggest for folks, if you'd like to learn more about the topic, the book is The Truth About Drug Companies, and the author, Marcia Angell, A-N-G-E-L-L, M.D., and the publisher is Random House, and I'm sure you can find it in bookstores and libraries. And to you, Dr. Angell, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it very much.
It was my pleasure.